Hello, and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast. This is Series 3. This is the NIHR Senior Research Leader Series, and do press follow wherever you listen to your podcasts. Listen right until the end, where we'll host a summary with Professor Roxanne Crosby-Nwabi, and do leave us a comment wherever you listen to your podcasts. Hello and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast for what will be our last episode for the Senior Research Leader Series. And I have to say, we got here eventually, and with me today is John Smith. So, John, you can explain why I said we got here eventually.
Well, morning, everybody. I mean, this is our second time, and we've, IT nightmare. So anyway, let's crack on.
Worth it in the end. And just as I'm saying that to you, there's a food van arrived outside Kiel that seemed to be playing a chime like an ice cream van. So we'll put up with whatever we need to put up with, John. It'll be fine.
We've just had a fire alarm.
It'll be absolutely, it's authentic. It's absolutely fine. So, John, I've got you down as lead nurse or lead research nurse for a CERT. You are an NIHR senior research leader. I'm going to take you right back to the beginning, like I do with everybody. Why did you become a nurse?
Yeah, why did I become a good question? I mean, I would love to say that it was a calling in life. It was my vocation. It was, and all this, which actually my partner, it was. I mean, she wanted to be a nurse from being a child. She finished school, she worked as a nursing assistant and straight into nursing. She's a fantastic nurse. For me, I was always going to be a solicitor. I wanted to be a solicitor. I wanted to earn lots of money, have a big house and a BMW. And that was my childhood aspiration. My dad was a miner. And when the pits closed, in the area was a big psychiatric hospital called Winterton, which wasn't really a hospital, it was more like a village. I mean, it's an amazing place. And he went to work there as a nursing assistant. And he went back to night school, and then he retrained as a nurse. And for him, he'd won the lottery. And he'd sort of said to me, listen, why don't you apply to do nursing? It's not like working down the pit 12 hours a day, breaking your back, blah, blah, blah. And so to kind of sort of pacify him, I suppose, I applied to the nursing just in the off chance that circumstances changed, and I suppose unfortunately I didn't get me the A level grades that I wanted to go to university and do law, and while I was waiting for my grades, I worked at Butlins as a barman for the summer, and it was nice having a bit of money, and it was always the intention to go back and resit. But I think I got the taste for the money, so I went and did nursing, because at the time, you were actually paid as a student nurse, and again, it was kind of like, well, I'll go back and do my A levels later. I'll go back and do, and I never did. I started my training at Durham in 1990, the nursing school, and which was then absorbed into Durham University, qualified in 1993. And I mean, despite what my dad said about not backbreaking work, I mean, I've not got arthritis in my hip and a bad back. But no regrets. Absolutely none whatsoever. I mean, I think it's a fantastic job. It's interesting. I mean, I've seen things and experienced things that, friends have never kind of sort of experienced in their life. And ironically, I've got a friend now who was a nurse, who's retrained as a barrister. And I don't think I'd fancy it. I don't think it's as sexy as what you think it might be. A lot of it's just kind of paperwork.
So your partner found a calling. Perhaps you did in the end.
Well, I think you have to be a certain, if you want to do a good job, you've got to be there for the right reasons. And I think yes, you have to be compassionate. Yeah. You have to really want to do it. It's a massively satisfying job. I mean, I sat through a meeting. I sat through a presentation once with a chief nurse who talked about emulating compassion, and my heart just sank a bit, because I kind of thought, if you're not compassionate, if you don't, I wouldn't say not care about people, but I think you've got to really want to do it.
Yeah.
But the rewards are there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we had, like I do with all guests, we had a bit of a pre-chat, And this is a very unique series in the senior research leader, because everybody academically is very different as a senior research leader. And you were very quick to say to me, I haven't taken the traditional academic route. So what was your route into research or a research role?
I think yes. I mean, it's very gracious of you to spare my blushes, but absolutely. I mean, I don't have a master's. I don't have a PhD. I kind of look around the SRL cohort, and I feel like a fraud, because there are so many. I mean, everybody's got a PhD, and deservedly so. I mean, there's some brilliant, brilliant, inspirational people, there. I mean, I listened to Tracy Long's podcast last week. Brilliant, amazing. Really, she thinks she's great. And I suppose what I although that's not to say, like you say, it's not to say I haven't had an academic kind of sort of career. But I have had opportunities as well there, with regrets. I did the postgraduate certificate or diploma in clinical research at the John Moore University, Liverpool, many moons ago, and I could have actually traded that up to a master's by doing an additional year. And I was like, oh, I'll do it later. I'll do it later, and never did. And then, so some subsequent years later, I was presenting electrical impedance tomography to a group at the Royal Brompton, and the course director for the Imperial course, a master's in cardiovascular physiology at Imperial, he was in the audience. And I got chatting to him, and he told me, and I was talking about doing a master's, there and then. And he was like, you shouldn't be doing a master's, you should be teaching on it, which is really nice of him to sort of like say. And again, I should have kind of sort of gone, well, I did kind of sort of make a start into, an application. Then we started a family. And when I spoke to sort of like the program director, she was like, I really, if you just found out your partner's pregnant, I think maybe you should kind of give it a break, kind of thing. And so I did, and again, never went back. I wish I'd had. If you remember when we were in Leeds like a few weeks ago, we had Liz Lee's Dutch or Deutsch, and she was talking, her program where she kind of coerces and cajoles and encourages, like, look, just a little bit more work, you could have so much more. I wish she'd been there with me, could coercing and cajoling me. But I mean, like I say, it's not like I haven't had an academic career. I mean, I've written a chapter in the European Intensive Care Society yearbook. I've got publications. I've presented in, well, I've been all over the place. I mean, San Francisco, Texas, Brussels. I've been to Pisa. I've been all over presenting stuff. I've worked with some fantastically clever, brilliant people and done some really sort of like brilliant stuff. I mean, I did some work with the National Physical Laboratory down in Teddington. We built an artificial circulation. That was pretty amazing. I've been on advanced ventilation courses in the Netherlands. I've been to the Charité in Berlin where we did the ECMO course, which is, I mean, my background's critical care. ECMO being extracorporeal membranous oxygenation, where we, when we can't ventilate patients, we have to take the blood out of the body and oxygenate it, basically. So I've done. I mean, I was kind of sort of reflecting on all this yesterday as I was thinking about the podcast, and I thought, do you know what? I haven't done too bad. I've had a very, very interesting, career and done some really, really, sort of clever stuff. I mean, we've, suffi I mean, I spent one Christmas, putting surfactant down patients' lungs. I spent another Christmas, in the H1N1 pandemic, sort of, doing sort of fun stuff. So,
But
yeah.
I don't think that there's a need for any blushes to spare, to sort of steal your phrase there. From talking to you, what you have been is a real enabler for other people. And it feels a bit like you've perhaps sacrificed some of your own opportunities for other people sometimes, which is the sign of a leader. So what drove you to that senior research leader post
Well,
and the research?
just before before I answer that question, I mean, it's nice of you to say. I mean, I think probably because of my background, I mean, I've, I'm really, really keen that we kind of develop our academic pipeline within our team. And to date, we've had three people complete their PhDs, three people currently doing their PhDs, six PCAFs, three Scopras. People on fellowships. We've got Dan Hadfield, who was our was an original 70 at 70 guy. He's currently work. He's just started on his HRA £2 million funded multi-center research trial. And I'm not going to take anything away from these guys. These guys, it's to their credit. It's their blood, sweat, and tears that they're putting into this stuff. Or but what I would I do like to think. I say yes as much as I can, and because I can say yes as much as I can, these guys are able to kind of, get on and do these things. So they'll come to me and say, "I'm thinking about doing this." I'm like, "Yeah, go for it," and we'll backfill your post, or we'll work out a way how to do it. And I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the guys. I think, we've done really, really well, and long may it continue. To your point, why the SRL? I mean, again, I per but. Purely by chance, good luck rather than good management. My boss, Anne-Marie Murta, she's our R&D director, who's been really, really good to me and our team. She sent the email out about the SRL program, and I kind of looked at it, and the first thing I thought was, right, Shana was one of my research nurses doing a PhD. I was like, Shan could do this. This would be great for her. It would give her the time, the resource, blah, 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 to develop a PhD and all this kind of stuff. So straight away, I'm looking for somebody, and when I looked at the criteria, you had to be a Band 8 to apply at the time. And I was like, well, I guess that's me then. And really, out of obligation to my director, I felt, she's been good to me. I should, the least I can do is kind of put in an application. Now, when I got into writing the application, I thought, God, I'd really, really like to do this. I would, re honestly, I mean, I was just so invested in it. I mean, I just thought, oh, God, wouldn't it be great if I could do this? Really got into the framework, really got into that mindset, really, and submitted. I mean, it was submitted at the 11th hour, because initially when I kind of wrote, I thought it's only like a couple hundred words per question. It's actually harder to get what you want to say in 200 words than it is in the, pages and pages. Submitted it. I mean, Declan, I think it was like 1 o'clock was the deadline. 10 to one, Declan's ringing me saying, John, I'm looking at you, I can see your application, but you need to get it in. And 5 to 1, he's ringing me again. I'm like, get off the phone, Declan. I need to get this application in. And I got it in, and then I waited and waited, and I didn't hear anything because I think there was a delay because they said like whatever date it was, they would, they'd let us know. And it came a bit late, and I thought, oh well, I just guess I haven't got it, and I was really sort of like disappointed. And then when I, and then when it came out, they're like, oh no, you got it. I was like, that's amazing, brilliant, super excited. And it was just, it was kind of, I mean, I'm 54-year-old, sitting there thinking, it's just a matter of time before I'm put out to pasture. And then I get kind of sort of accepted on the SRL program, and I think, oh, actually, do you know what? Maybe some people think I'm worth taking a punt on, and it was really, really nice. So yeah.
So
And I
you've
have to
been an
say,
enabler, John. I'm thinking you've been an enabler. Has this enabled you? What's it allowed you to do for yourself
I'm
and
hoping
others?
for the future. I mean, I mean, one of the nice, well, I hope this doesn't come back to bite me, but one of the nice things about the SRL program is you get treated like you're an adult. And from the get-go, they've sort of said, like, look, we're investing in you. We're not, we trust you enough to do, et cetera, et cetera. And that's really, really nice because you can. And I'd like, now my sort of project, if you like, hasn't gone smoothly by a long stretch of the imagination. Bracken see it going beyond the SRL program. I mean, I can, I would say the SRL will hopefully, if everything works, it will change my future. I mean, the SRL program for me, one of the big things was, is it kind of, it opened up a world outside of of our trust. The NHS Trust, the whole NI, the people you meet, the networks, it just, there's a whole world out above trust level. That's how I best can best explain it, really. And I was never plugged into that. And even, and those kind of relationships, I would like to think would go on, I'm jumping the gun a bit because you're probably going to ask me where to, what's the future kind of thing. But it's appraisal season. I had my appraisal last month, and I'm already putting in the groundwork to persuade my boss to basically create some kind of role to enable me to do this when the SRL program finishes. And I know that's an aspiration of Roxy's. This is the idea that it's almost like a it's almost not a fail, but you know what I mean? It would be disappointing if all of the guys who roll off the SRL program then just go back to their everyday life that was before the SRL program. And I think the guys in our cohort are feeling that at the moment, because it's 6 or 7 months away, and it's not long.
And I suppose it puts you not under pressure, because this has been a gift, really, to have 2 days funded. It's felt that way to me, and it's engaged me in the way that it's brought you out of sort of a trust and more into academia. It's taken me a little bit out of academia and back into a trust to get a bit more of an NHS feel. But it has made me feel like I've almost got to carve my own niche here and sort of think to myself, I've got to make myself irreplaceable, which is hard. But you sort of want to be able to say, when this comes to an end, it's been so successful, shall we keep this going? That's the way I view it. Is that how your cohort are viewing it?
I mean, again, I think it's different for different people, because of what they've used the SRL for. I mean, I mean, I was fortunate. My manager was very supportive and said, "Yeah, John, there you go. You can have your 2 days a week." Blah blah. Some people have had to use the SRL kind of sort of fellowship to effectively continue on doing the job that they're already doing. You know, they're in very sort of tenuous, precarious position, shall we say. I wasn't like that, and I really appreciate that. But then you look at people like Tracy. I say last week, she's now a nurse consultant, and I think that's kind of sort of the SRL program has enabled her to achieve that. I think I can't. I mean, honestly, it is a fantastic opportunity. And I'd love it to go on. I'd love for the NIHR to say, "Right, guys, we've found some money, and you can all just carry on doing what you're doing for forever." But and I suppose that's the I but we can. You've also got to be realistic. I mean, I work in a trust that's £200 million overspent, and I mean, this is one of the issues I've got, with some of my projects. There's job freezes. There's scrutiny over sort of job roles. There's actually there's pressure to actually downgrade nursing roles, which again breaks my heart. So you've got to kind of sort of tread carefully. Get people on board, show the value. I mean, I'm hoping the work that, if I can demonstrate the work that I'm doing actually pays for itself, I'm hoping that's enough.
And the backfill and the funds that come in from the people you've supported to do fellowships and gain awards means that research brings in a high income if it's done well, doesn't it?
I think, I mean, so we there's a certain protection in with our within research within the hospital because of the money it brings in. And it was interesting again at Leeds, Anita Hansen, kind of when she was talking about her clinical academic tracker, and not just kind of keeping a record of achievements and awards that people have achieved, but also monetizing it, kind of sort of saying, "Look, this is what we've brought in, and these fellowships, these PhDs, is actually there's a cost, there's money attached to it, and I think we need to kind of showcase that a bit more as well."
And going back to you and your role, I mean, you spoke to me briefly, really, about almost and you hope the SRL role helps this and influences it, but you've got ideas around academic roles in the NMC. Tell us a little bit about that as well, some ideas that you'd had.
So, I don't know whether you remember. I think it's not the Leeds meeting just gone, but it was a Leeds meeting. I think it was last year, or about a year, year and a half ago. And we had somebody called Emma Westcott come from the NMC, and she's the sort of strategic director for the NMC. And she, in the nicest possible way, she came on a bit of a charm offensive, because I mean, the only time we have any dealings with the NMC is really disciplinary issues, striking people, and I think they've also got a bit that put. You need to work on the public image as well, and she admitted this. And it was kind of sort of sitting in a room full of people who've all these guys, all these inspirational people who've got PhDs, masters, they've really, really worked their socks off, and are so proud. I mean, it is, it's all it's awe-inspiring, if you like. And but we don't record it. It's not, the people's academic achievements aren't captured anywhere. And it just occurred to me that the NMC, the register, professional register, is the place to do it, because whether you're it, any every nurse in who are currently practicing in the UK is on that register, whether they're in private practice, whether they're working for the NHS, whatever they're doing. And it's unique in that respect. And if we kind of sort of captured people's academic, I mean, I know we do postgraduate qual, courses, but why not academic? I mean, if we kind of, you've got like the Karen group and, other groups who are kind of sort of pushing for, postdoctoral academic pathways, or, a career pathway for all these guys. We can't, until we know who's out there and what's everybody got, we can't kind of sort of, work on that, I suppose. If we had this information, I mean, again, the NMC, the register doesn't even capture the specialty that people work in. It, like, which trust you're working at. But if we captured things like, it's already collecting sort of like demographic information, ethnicity. If you captured specialties and academic attainment and stuff, you could look for geographical variation. Are people in London getting more opportunities than people in Liverpool, for example? Are people in the community getting less opportunity than people in big teaching hospitals? We can look at diversity. Let's have a look at, let's have a look at the demographic of people who've got PhDs, masters. Are there underserved populations that we need to reach out to? And the best way to capture all this is via the NMC, sort of register. Now, I kind of posed this to Emma, and there's a bit of a lukewarm reception, if I say. I mean, the room were on fire about it. The room were kind of very, very supportive, because they would be. Why wouldn't you want to kind of sort of celebrate your achievements? A bit lukewarm, and I think it could be a resource thing. She mentioned GDPR. I'm not really, I don't, I can't see GDPR being a barrier in particular. I mean, they're capturing ethnicity data, etc. So why not? And people could voluntarily offer this information, not complete the fields if they didn't want to. And I did kind of sort of think, do you know what, we could do a collaboration. And I mean, one of my main project, I'm getting a database guy in. My database guy could possibly work with the NMC to kind of sort of add these fields or whatever. But you've got to start somewhere. And what I thought was, do you know, we don't even know the academic attainments of the nurses in our kind of sort of trust. So we're doing this survey called Elevate, which is educational level evaluation for nurses and allied teams. And what we're doing is, it's a questionnaire basically asking, to try and basically describe the academic, landscape of our nurses and midwives in the trust. How many of our nurses have got masters? How many have got PhDs? How many have done it in their own time? How many have paid for it themselves? Because that is quite common. How many people would like to do a master's or a PhD, and what are those barriers? And ultimately, our ultimate question is, would you be happy for the NMC to capture, collect this data, in the future? And we've got a work, I mean, we've got a workforce of over 4,000 nurses and midwives. So we're on our way to kind of sort of recruit 2,000, to get 2,000 sort of surveys completed. I think that's going to give us a massive amount of data in terms of, like I say, intra-specialty variation of, education. We do capture, demographics and ethnicity. And I don't think there's going to be any surprises. There'll be a it'll be a lot, a lot of people sort of like saying, yeah, I'd love to do a master's, I'd love to do a PhD, but it's time and money. But there's also things. I mean, I've just looking having a preliminary look at the data and stuff, and things come up also, like things like, lack of mentorship. That's We would like a mentorship. Lack of direction. We don't know where to go. And that's where out. That's where we're kind of sort of failing at our job, if you like. One of the other questions is, do you have research as part of your job role? Are you aware of research going on in your department? And it's quite interesting, because again, we think we're brilliant, and when you get out there and you're actually sort of speaking to these people, yeah, they'll say to you, no, I'm not aware of any research. And you think, well, that's down to us, that really. That's our kind of sort of failing.
And the
So that.
SRL, as cohorts have all been sort of guided towards the SORT tool, haven't we? Is that
I
something
mean,
you've used, or have you been influenced by that at
so
all? Because some of the questions seem quite similar.
had a bit of a foray into, well, like, I mean, I thought that this would dovetail nicely with the SORT tool, to be honest with you, because this tells you about your workforce. And I think, particularly with questions like, do you have research in your job plan? Do you have time ring fence for research? Academic aspirations, that kind of thing. So I kind of think it harmonizes with the SORT tool. We have had a look at the SORT tool. We want to do some pilot work. Claire Harris, who was actually my boss, but is now sort of head of nursing for workforce at Guy's and St Thomas's, and she's a real force for good as well. We kind of sort of we're part of what you call King's Health Partners. We're kind of sort of we're buddied up with the Brompton and GSTT, and she's kind of sort of I think she's steering the SORT tool across the three areas. And she sent out an email last week looking for interested sort of people to get interested in kind of the rollout and doing it, and I've thrown my hat in the ring for that kind of thing.
And I suppose with your ideas with the NMC, really, I mean, if it became a mandatory fields for people when they revalidated, then you're no longer researching a sample of a population, you're researching the population of nurses because you've got them all.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the beauty of the NMC. Can you see the passion I've got? But that's the beauty of the NMC. You've got someone like it's got 830,000, 850,000 people on the professional register, and you revalidate every 3 years, which means it's always up to date. Because the problem we've got is when we employ somebody, we get their application, we say, oh, this person's got a degree. They work in the trust for 5 years, go on and do a master's, which they paid for themselves and done in their own time, and nobody's none the wiser. Whereas if you've got those fields, for want of a couple of three fields in the NMC revalidation database, then you could have all that. And absolutely, I mean, just the power of the data. I said just the geographical variability,
And
the variation of specialties, the demographics.
we talk about research readiness. It feels like over the last few years, the RCN have stepped up. It feels like in community and primary care settings, the Queen's Nursing Institute, we've got the Caring Group, we've got the NIHR, we've got NHS England currently. Perhaps the NMC is the one missing part of the picture to really step up and try and celebrate research attainment and academic attainment, like you say.
Gosh, I can't even remember it. Who's the chief executive of the this is really bad. Chief executive of the RCN.
You're putting me on the spot now. I'd be Googling at this point.
Oh my God. Nicola Ranger. So Nicola Ranger used to be our chief nurse here at King's. I'm hoping for an audience with her. Again, the kind of, because I think, yeah, it doesn't matter how it gets done, just as long as it gets done. And I think the reason why how you have these great ideas and you're absolutely convinced it's such a good idea, and then somebody kind of knocks you down by sort of pointing something out that you fail to realize, and takes the wind out. I can't believe anybody can kind of sort of knock this one down, because I can't think of a better repository, if you like. I can't think of a more efficient way of doing it. And to be honest with you, I mean, it's a no-brainer. It would suit the NMC. If the
Of course.
NMC really are kind of keen to kind of sort of improve their image, if you like, then why wouldn't they? I mean, it's a bit crass to say this, but the NMC work for us. We are they're there for us. We pay our registration. We and really, I'd like to think they kind of sort of would listen to us.
I wonder whether the NMC sees themselves as there for us, or see
Well, I
themselves
don't.
as or see themselves as there for society, to keep us on a register. I think, are they there to safeguard the society, or are they there for us? It's a question, isn't it?
But even if they're there for society, I mean, I think again from what Emma was saying is that the public are a bit kind of sort of. I mean, I don't even know whether the public know what the NMC are, but I think that I have read, I think it was something in the Guardian recently about sort of like the public of don't have a very positive view of sort of like the NMC. Now, having this data on the in the NMC database is a sort of a safety check as well. I mean, if you're looking to, if you've got a potential applicant and you're looking to recruit, et cetera, you can then check on that database. Do they have what they say they have? Have they got a PhD? Have they got a master? I think it covers all bases, really.
I certainly know when it's a long time ago now, but when I got my PhD and wanted the NMC to know I'd got my PhD, I had to send them the certificate, to
Right.
prove, I had to provide the evidence, and it couldn't be a photocopied one. They had to see the original. So they were there. They were safeguarding the sense that if I was saying I'd got a doctorate, that I actually had one. So they do that right. But I think what you've really raised there is this would be big data on the entire population of nursing and midwifery workforce, and what we could do with it to show inequality, inequity would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, of the data I've looked at in our surveys so far, I'm surprised because that would be higher than this. 86%, only 86%, answered yes to would you be happy for the NMC to collect this data in the future? And I thought it would be higher, but the comments that are kind of associated with that is, well, they're already capturing too much data. Although, there's a kind of sort of a skepticism and a cynicism and a worry about, a big brother kind of thing. So it's got to be handled sensitively.
So as we draw the interview to a close, John, I think the question for you, because I can tell you're an enabler, and quite selfless, because you don't speak about yourself a great deal. You tend to speak about others and what you can do for others. So I suppose my final question for you is, if we don't allow you to be put out for pasture and you don't wish to be, what are your ambitions then? What do you want to do beyond the award, and what do you want to do in your role or future roles?
Because I've spent so long just, talking and talking, I haven't even spoken about my project proper, which is informatics. And, I would love to sort of, carry on doing what I'm doing with the informatics, which is using informatics to do the heavy lifting of research delivery. And I suppose, if I could create a role, I mean, and again, it's very topical at the moment, sort of, the three shifts, analog to digital. The chief nurse's strategy was, using digital sort of transformation to the NIHR strategy, digital tools to improve capacity and capability and be able to offer research to, more people. So I'd love to kind of sort of be a bit more embedded in that, and I would love to, again, you have your appraisal, and so the last question is, where do you see yourself next year? Do you the same, moving sideways, moving up? And I usually tick all three because you just never, never do. But this year, I sort of said to my boss, I was like, do you know what? I'd like to move up, and I, you know, I, are there opportunities outside of the trust in the NIHR? For the, there's got to be, because I think data and digital transformation, it's the future. I've been doing the Topol Fellowship. That was something else that came out of the SRL. Which is another, and that's about digital transformation in healthcare, and the stuff that's going on with AI and big data sets, and I mean, yeah, and I'd really like to be part of it.
Well, reputationally, John, I can say that I only ever hear positive things when people have mentioned your name. I think the SRL award has always been there to elevate people, and I think Roxanne would be the first to say she hopes it does. And
I.
we wish you well going forward for the remainder of the award. So I'm going to say, John Smith, thank you for your time.
Thanks very much.
Delighted to have you on, and a really great episode. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Take care.
Hello and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher Podcast. We're here again with what will be, unfortunately, our final episode of the Senior Research Leader Series. Always delighted, for the final time, Perhaps not. You never know one day. But for the final time for now for this series, I'm going to say hello to you again, Roxanne.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
And it's been great to do this. This is the first time that I've sort of got together with somebody differently, and so that I have a different approach to this podcast series. And it's been a delight, really, to be a senior research leader myself, to be able to support you a little bit with this and say, let's promote the program. It's been lovely, and I think you've made five very, very good choices. You're very praising of us all. You're very supportive of us all as a leader, and I think you've gone out of your way to choose five very different people to give a different story of each of the people's message on the program, really. Would you agree?
Yeah, it was quite important to me and also to the program to demonstrate the depth and the breadth of individuals that we've awarded this Senior Research Leadership Fellowship to really demonstrate that within, the first three cohorts of senior nurses and midwives, we have individuals who have gone above and beyond to increase research capability and capacity within the workforce, and they've done absolutely amazing things. We've been able to, show people from a health visitor background, from mental health, from across the system, from community care. And that's been really important to me to be able to show what the program has been able to achieve and will be able to achieve, not just within the 3 years, but we're hoping to take on the mantle and the sustainability project and, carry on with the work thereafter, because it will pay dividends, and it has paid dividends in the initial funding for 3 years.
Yeah, and a good time at the end of this final episode of the series to remind people that cohort 4 will soon be there and ready for people to apply for.
Yes, cohort 4, we have nurses, midwives, and allied health professionals. This time round, we're opening on the 3rd of September, and our webinar's on the 2nd of September.
Yeah, so we encourage everybody to go along and listen and never feel. I think that what the episodes have shown people is never feel like you aren't suitable for this. Everybody, some very diverse roles that we've discussed with very different people across the five episodes. We've all got different stories to tell in these cohorts. We all learn a great deal from one another and are encouraged by one another. But I think we've been able to showcase the real difference across our own discipline with this. And now it's broadened to allied health professions as well. So it's a real opportunity, isn't it, now to because we need research is multidisciplinary, and therefore
Is.
we have to not be looking at it as a discipline specific role. And I think this is a great opportunity now to step into cohort 4 and see what the new cohort will bring.
Yes, and I'm super excited as the lead to be able to do that, because it's a new space for me. We've been leading nurses and midwives, but allied health professions, they work in their own space, but then we always cross and we always interlink as an MDT. So it'll be interesting for me as the program leader to understand what they bring into the senior research leadership space and how
Yeah.
I can help them develop. So I completely, welcome with open arms this new
Yeah.
perspective, this new
Yeah.
journey that we're about to embark on.
Yeah, will be great to go from strength to strength. Talking of that diversity, here's John Smith,
Yay!
our final episode. We had a chuckle at the beginning because John and I just could not make the IT work. It took a while for us to get the IT work between the two of us. And John's a real character, and I was delighted to get John on board. And he very much set this up. You hear a lot of people on these episodes talk about mum was a nurse, and John started with this. Dad was a miner, backbreaking work, and at a time when the mines were closing. John's dad must have been an inspiration to go off and do something completely different, like becoming perhaps a nursing assistant and then becoming a nurse. And to have seen that at that time would have been really novel, and probably quite a perhaps not a masculine role at that time for somebody who'd been down the mine. So that fascinated me that his dad had been a role model as a nurse at that time. Did you pick that up?
Yeah, I completely agree. But what I did chuckle at was when he said, the dad said to him, it's not as backbreaking work as
Yeah.
mining. Those of us who've been about 20 years might not agree, with the Australian lift and everything else. But yeah, going from where he was, to seeing his dad, making a full career decision, move, okay, I can no longer support my family doing this, I'm going to do something else. That must have been very inspirational for young John.
Yeah, I thought so, and I you could see that. in the way that we think John is a role model for people, the way that he developed quite a unique career, his father was clearly his role model. And I think, I was like you. I was laughing along when he said that his father thought he'd won the lottery to get this kind of job that wasn't backbreaking. And I was thinking, sitting here with my sciatica after many years of perhaps incorrectly getting people out of chairs, that it still is backbreaking work if you're not doing it correctly, perhaps. So I spotted that as well and chuckled along. But one of the things I'm going to pinpoint just before I sort of let you tell us a little bit about your feelings about John and his career and his role is that he sort of said I'd spared his blushes a little bit, because John was very quick to point out that actually, beyond his what you might call his routine qualification to become a nurse, his nursing qualification, he hadn't taken the academic route. But he hadn't needed to, had he? He's been such an inspirational person, and he's facilitated a lot, so much for other people, and then led so much for other people, that it, without getting to the end point of our chat, this SRL program was there to finally validate him, wasn't it? That's what it's done.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And throughout the podcast, you kept using the word enabler. But it was interesting that, he said he felt like a fraud. And that just goes back, I guess, to me and the adverts that we do for this program. Are people thinking that you need to have a PhD or a master's to be able to do this? But you don't. You absolutely don't. You just have to demonstrate senior research leadership in terms of capacity and capability building. And John has done that in absolute spades. Yes, he can go on and do a master's and a PhD at some other point in life if he wants to. But for what he's done for the members of staff around him, and he was quite proud to talk about his previous 70 at 70 colleague who has a £2 million HRA trial. And he's done so much to enable these individuals. I'm quite proud of John.
Yeah, I think so. And the way he talks about publishing, he's published textbooks, he's published papers, a lot of traveling in his role. What he's had is a really nice career thus far, and a really productive career. And what he's done for people, you can imagine if we were doing a podcast with some of the people he has enabled, they'd be championing him and saying, I couldn't have done it without John. And that's the kind of thing you can't stick on a CV, really, isn't it? It comes back to you almost in testimonies. But there's a sense with me that I think he's inspired a great deal of people, and there'll be a number of people out there working around and for John and with John that have thought I couldn't have done it without him.
Absolutely agree. But I think the best bit about that bit of the story for me was he said, I'm about to be put out to pasture, but the SRL program has given him a morale boost. So it's almost paying back what he's put out. Him being recognized because of everything that he's done, he's now getting the recognition and it's now spurring him to do other things. And later on, he'll speak about the projects that he's currently involved in. And again, the projects are all about other people, getting others on the research ladder. And that just signifies, who John is.
And it's a nursing thing. I mean, I've done quite a bit of qualitative research where I've been asking nurses about themselves, and you struggle to get them talk about themselves. It's always the people, it's the patients or the workforce. They rarely are able to talk about themselves and really recognize their own value and or potential. And John's just has utilized his full potential and has had great value to people. We shouldn't gloss over it. He's got quite strong opinions about the NMC and about the changing face of the NMC. And we have to say on a podcast, John's opinions are his own, and they're not that of the podcast necessarily. But I don't think he said anything that was too questioning. I just think he got quite strong views in that area, hadn't he? And I think that's come through years of experience and in him seeing him wanting to see things evolve and change a little.
No, I agree. But the points he made about having our academic achievements recognized and documented, whether it's through the NMC or another body, it needs to be done. We need to move forward as a profession. And I know the Karen Network is currently working on, doing stuff like that. So if it's not the NMC, if it's not the Karen Group, there are other people all working in this space to get stuff done. Because as John has rightly pointed out, we need to talk about health inequalities. We need to talk about geographical variation. We need to look at our own workforce and think, okay, If we are not diverse, if they're underserved groups, if they're groups not being involved in research, how can we even hope to get to the patients who need to be gotten to? So he has an absolute valid point, and there, many ways it's going to catch.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we had a brief chat before we started to record, but that sense of this award allowed him to turn the mirror on himself a little bit was really interesting to hear, because even with this award, he thought to himself, right, who can I support to go for this? And it took
Yes.
somebody else to say to him, you're the senior research leader, you go for this. So it just shows that selfless nature to some extent, and that a lack of recognition of his own value until this. So it really has given him that bit of validation again. A little bit like we said the la with the last episode with Connie, it's validated what they do.
Yeah, I think we need to, again, my thanks to my researcher hat coming on. We need to look at the literature on do people choose nursing, or does nursing choose people? Is it that we all are that way, or are we trained to be that way? That's a good question.
I've struggled to get nurses to talk about themselves, so to do it in a podcast has been a very different way of doing it, but they're always thinking about the people they work for and support and serve more so than themselves, and he was a classic example of that, really.
I quite like that he said on the program, you're treated like an adult. And I'm like, okay, what does that mean? But he got the autonomy to, run with his ideas on the program. And he felt invested in as an individual and recognized as a senior research leader. Because I guess one of the first things we say on our very first induction meeting, you have been rubber stamped by the NIHR as a senior research leader. You've got these skills, you know what needs to be done. Go forth and do it.
And I hope that being chosen for this episode, I think, for perhaps listening back to his own story and recognizing how people view him on our cohort, that he sees himself as a true leader, because there's a lot of people that if they're in these settings and they haven't got their own PhD, they seem to think that that puts them on some different level. It doesn't at all. It was never about having a PhD to come on to this program for me. That's just something I have in my role, and others do in their role. We have professors, we have research delivery champions, we have people at all different levels on the cohorts. And unless John feels the need to tell people, like, I didn't do a master's degree, or I haven't done a PhD, nobody's looking for it. Nobody's looking for that. Well, I just thought, gentlemen, senior research leader, be great to hear what you're doing in your area. His academic qualifications re weren't relevant to me in that sort of conversation, and they don't need to be. You don't need to have a PhD to be a research leader.
You absolutely do not. It's all about your people skills, I guess, and your planning and your innovation. Yeah, okay, you have a PhD, you've killed some brain cells along the way, but that's not going to make you a research leader in that space in terms of building capacity, going on the shop floor, encouraging the young ones, or maybe even the older ones to get involved in research, to use research to underpin practice. It's all about you as a person, and that's who we were looking for, and that's who we got.
Yeah, I hope this inspires him not to feel that he's the kind of person that's going to be put out to pasture. I hope what this gives him is a crossroads of choice. When he comes to the end of his program, he's at the start. In the program in the cohort that he's in, he's got several years to work with this now to really develop himself, as well as the people that he's trying to support.
Or maybe using his own analogy, he can choose the pasture he wants to go out on.
Absolutely. It's a great platform for that, isn't it? And the SRL program is a leveler across the cohort. In cohorts, it's a leveler. We all know what we're here to do. We all know what we put in our applications and what we wanted to achieve. And we've not been set the same goals. What we've been asked to do is recognize where the deficiencies are, the gaps, and work in our own populations, and do what we need to do. And he does that incredibly well.
Yeah, and the best thing about your program for me is the networking. To be able to, get out of your own bubble, as it was, and get out of your own head and speak to other people who may be having similar issues. He spoke at length about the Elevate study that he's doing, looking at the academic landscape of NMAPS within the trust. And I'm thinking, I literally emailed him and I'm like, John, this program, can you, do you have the do you have permissions to allow us to showcase this on the SRL program? Because there may be new people coming into the new cohort, or even the older cohort, who would like to do a similar piece of work on who, haven't been able to get that information to be able to work with. Can we have your protocol or something? So, the networking opportunities, and we've got 81 SRLs on the program and 81 different voices, and we are growing, hopefully, a groundswell of individuals who are going to change practice up and down the country.
It's Roxanne, it's been wonderful to be able to do this. I know we've had a gap in the middle of our five episodes, but it's been wonderful to be able to showcase five people, that were rightfully selected. And what I would say is, to anybody that's listened to these series, is do put yourself forward, do consider yourself somebody who has the right value and the right background to do this, and somebody that can, if you feel you can offer the kind of examples of things that have been seen, or you're already doing that and you need the validation of it, then do consider applying for cohort four. I'll what I'll say is I'll look forward to seeing you in the RCN Research International Research Conference. Are we Exeter this year? Exeter
Yes, we
comes to
are.
mind.
Yes.
Exeter. So I'll look forward to seeing you in person there. And just a huge thank you for giving me the opportunity to do this specialist series and to do the summaries with you. It's been lovely to be able to have a chat and to talk around people and see how like-minded we all are in this area.
Thank you for inviting us, and thank you for being willing to use your platform to showcase the great work that you and other colleagues are doing.
No problem at all. I'll invite people to come and say hello to us if they know what we look like. To do come and say hello at the conference if people are there in September. I don't. I'm always happy to be tapped on the shoulder if people want to chat about this or the podcast or anything like that. And one thing nursing is around research is very inclusive. People are very supportive of one another. So never feel you can't drop people an email or give them a tap on the shoulder. And we're around. We're having a lot of our cohort will be there meeting. Several cohorts will be meeting for those that go to the RCN conference. Really looking forward to that. So, Roxanne, I shall see you soon. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Andrew.
Bye bye.